Returning to Shattering Myths, it's a pleasure to be with you this morning. We're going to turn the page and consider Yahweh's testimony. We were in the middle of analyzing the consequence of political correctness and the two ways that people are precluded from knowing and understanding in our program yesterday, where we talked about the fact that in Western countries where information is ubiquitous, the educational system, the political system, and the media collectively discourage people from exercising good judgment. You have everything from outcome-based math to no classes on rhetoric or logic to this misguided notion, the illogical, irrational notion of we are intolerant of intolerance, and where certain things cannot be said even if they are true. And so the failure to exercise good judgment is indoctrinated into the culture. It's what has happened in America. So Nick's point in that first hour when we were talking about America not being able to learn from the mistakes of others or from its own mistakes, learning requires the exercise of good judgment. You have to be discerning and discriminating to be able to learn. You know, there's a difference between knowing, learning, and then ultimately understanding. And without exercising your conscience, without your nesama, without deploying good judgment, you can't learn. And that is the problem in the West. We have taken two or three generations of people, and we have indoctrinated them in politically correct academic institutions to the point that they're incapable of learning. They can't process information, and therefore they cannot make a just, moral, or rational decision. And so their government can pull the wools over their eyes, can lie to them, can do all manner of horrible things and get by with it because they're not able to recognize that what their government is doing is immoral. They'll wave the flag and stand and salute as the national anthem is played with no recognition whatsoever that what is being done is heinous, immoral, inappropriate. In this regard, I can provide overwhelming proof that Yahweh exists. You read yada yada with the systematic presentation of his creation account, the systematic presentation of the flood and how it occurred and what testimony we have to validate it. And then the account of the Exodus, followed by all of the prophetic statements. And there is no way that an open-minded, informed, and rational person will come to any other conclusion than God proved his existence. And that he proved that he authored the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. So it's extraordinarily easy to prove that Yahweh exists and that he authored his Torah, prophets, and Psalms. Anyone willing to invest the effort with an open mind that is capable of being rational will know for certain. He revealed his plan of relationship and salvation to us in his Torah. But it seldom resonates with those who have been poisoned by man's religious schemes. It's very difficult for them to pull the scales of corruption from their eyes so that they can even process the information. We can reveal the fate that awaits mankind over the next 20 years, tell you exactly what's going to happen and how these calamities are going to ultimately bring down the world as we know it, killing billions of people, laying out the exact path that mankind is going to follow to his own demise. Showing that these things were predicted 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 years ago. And yet, no one seems to care. Not no one. Many people do care. Many people, as a result of this program and these books, have come to know Yahweh and have embraced his covenant. But they are the few among the many. As a result, all of man's political and religious schemes oppress and fleece the masses by beguiling them, by controlling them, either controlling access to information or by criminalizing thoughtfulness. For example, during the millennia-long political and religious domination of Roman Catholicism, the union of church and state kept the population ignorant and enslaved. The same can be said of communism during the last century. And throughout most of these periods, anyone who challenged the edicts of a Catholic or Orthodox Christian cleric, a communist or fascist dictator, or an Islamic caliph, was tortured and then killed. Discernment was not allowed, because reason is the enemy of all political and religious schemes. Today in the West, the universal application of political correctness assures that anyone in the public arena who is judgmental will be condemned, humiliated, and silenced. The reason that America was so upset that Snowden released the NSA snooping evidence, the reason that Bradley Manning was prosecuted for revealing the malfeasance of the U.S. government and the U.S. military is because they recognize that with evidence, there's still enough people out there that can process that evidence to hold the government accountable, to show that it isn't worthy of our support. They fear that. Now, having traveled in nearly 150 countries and having studied history, I can tell you that man's legacy is abysmal. For nearly 6,000 years across the face of this planet, a malignant concoction of politics and religion has served to enslave the masses for the benefit of cleric and king. And even that was not enough for the unending line of ruthless, egocentric leaders. They have always coveted more. They're never satiated. So with revolting regularity, cleric and king would send their subjects off to war to confiscate more land, more power, more tribute, more territory for themselves. On a global scale, man's history, both ancient and modern, is very troubling, with only occasional moments of good brightening an otherwise hideous tapestry. Given the choice between good and evil, leaders with a choice have almost universally chosen evil. Throughout time, the overwhelming preponderance of people have had their freedoms disseminated through a mix of oppression and fear. Choosing to live outside the religious and political constructs of these men and their schemes enjoins such severe consequences, most people abrogate whatever freedom they may otherwise have enjoyed. It's what we witness in America. It's what we witness in every Islamic country. It's what we witness in every communist and socialist country. It's too hard for most people to stand up against the roaring tide of humanity, to go in a different direction, just to bow their back and say, no, I'm not following you there. To be an American, for example, and to say what we're planning to do in Syria is suicidal. What we did in Afghanistan and Iraq were suicidal. What we did in Vietnam was counterproductive. To say those things puts one at odds with most Americans. It's difficult to do. Painful to do. The consequence of telling people the truth, of trying to awaken them to the truth, is difficult. Very few people are willing to do it. It's the most compassionate thing to do, and yet you'll be labeled hateful for doing it. For those who have read the whole of Yada Yada, you have discovered that God told us what would happen. He prophetically predicted that the consequence of the world's hypocritical political and religious leaders, those who say one thing and do another, would be seared beyond recovery. And that he warned us as a result that knowledge would increase and man would become increasingly foolish, listening only to those who would tell them what they wanted to hear. To this end, George W. Bush announced that central to making good decisions, his means to exercising good judgment and making good decisions was, according to Georgie Boy, being positive. You know, that's the nature of politics. The nature of even successful radio shows is that if you give people hope, even if the hope is unfounded, you'll be popular. That's how religions became popular. They provide people with hope. Hope is false, but it doesn't matter. That's how political parties become popular. They provide people with hope. Oh, yeah, you elect us and we'll make this better. Well, they never do. But people continue to believe. Change we can believe in, this president ran. That was his mantra. He didn't change anything. But they still believe. Yes, George Bush was right. Being positive is the stuff that makes politicians popular. It's what makes religions popular. It's what makes radio shows popular. But what more heinous thing can an individual do than try to gain leverage by coming across as being hopeful when that which they are proposing is hopeless? There is no hope in the Republican political party or the Democratic political party. There is no hope in religion. And yet these institutions give people false hope because it makes them popular. Just as George Bush says, central to good decisions. Not decisions that are wise, not decisions that are moral, not decisions that are right, but good decisions that are good for the politician is being positive. Part of what made Ronald Reagan, mystique, so invading of the U.S. conscience. You know, he's still revered as almost a demagogue by conservatives. Why? Because he offered hope. He rode tall in the saddle. Now we bankrupt America. They don't hold him accountable for that. But he did. You know, his great scheme was that we'll build up the U.S. military, and because the Soviets can't compete, we'll destroy the Soviet Union. We'll win the Cold War by building up the U.S. military. Well, yeah, he did bring down the Soviet Union. But he destroyed America, too. We just have taken longer to die. That wasn't hopeful. You don't create hope through a military excursion, through building up one's military might. And yet we have a whole nation that is devoted to the hopefulness of the sacrifice of our military servants. Go return in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. Information and reason, my friends, have given way to false hope because of religion and politics, because of academia, because of the media. But by the crowning achievement in hypocrisy goes to the Nazi Pope Pius the 12th and his army of armed priests who brutally slaughtered hundreds of thousands of Orthodox Christians and Jews and then danced on their corpses. It's part of our history, and when you look at the history of political leaders and religious leaders, it is almost always the history of hypocrisy, of moral decadence. By way of our schools and media, an entire generation, I would say several generations, have now been raised to view political correctness as the appropriate and undeniable moral code. They have been taught that man can solve his own problems and that science has the answers, even to the conception of life itself. You know that there are no experiments now being conducted anywhere on the conception of life. We've finally recognized that it just isn't possible. None. You know there are no experiments being conducted as to define the nature of human or animal souls or consciousness. None. We recognize that we don't know anything about the fundamentals of life. Knowledge, apart from the source of our very existence, has led to death and decay of humankind on an unprecedented scale. The more we know, the more foolish and lethal we have become. Now, turning our attention back to the text of Bar-Reshith, to Genesis 2:9, we read, And the tree of knowledge, Dayat. This is the acquisition of information with a focus and application of discernment and judgment for the purpose of understanding. So this is not just information, my friends. This is information with the intent of it being processed in a discerning and discriminating manner. So through the exercise of good judgment, understanding is possible. Understanding of what? Is the question. So the tree of the knowledge of good and bad, Tob and Ra. Tob, that which is prosperous and beneficial, proper, favorable, discernible, desirable, agreeable, even joyful, good. Yahweh calls his Torah, Tob, good, prosperous, beneficial, favorable, desirable. His covenant is Tob, good. He himself, he says, I am Tob, prosperous, beneficial, joyful, agreeable, desirable. Tob, good. That's good. And bad, he says, raw. Raw, harmful, evil, morally inappropriate, malignant, disagreeable, of no value, morally depraved, displeasing, and sad. So we discover that Tob and raw are opposites. They are prosperous and valueless, favorable and harmful, moral and inappropriate, beneficial and malignant, joyous and sad. Behaviors and attitudes, ambitious in deeds, doctrines and teachings, even foods can be judged as such and be placed on one side or the other of these categories. And that is the purpose of our seat of judgment, our nesama, is to discriminate between good and bad, between favorable and harmful, between prosperous and valueless. Is it prosperous, good, useful for us to bomb Syria? Or is that harmful, inappropriate, and will it create sadness? You can use your nesama, your seat of judgment, to examine everything in life and determine whether or not it is good or bad, right or wrong, useful or counterproductive. And that's what's being presented here. Now, before we consider why there would be such a tree in the sheltered enclosure known as the Garden of Great Joy, the Gan Eden, be aware that there was nothing unique about its Tob good nature. Earlier in the same statement, we read that Yahweh Almighty caused to sprout up and grow every good tree which was desirable and pleasing in appearance and good. Tob, beautiful and beneficial. Every tree was good. Every tree was good. It was good to look at. It was good to eat. Every tree. So this tree had good too. So what made this tree unique? This tree also had bad. And once you know bad, now you have to make a decision between them. Everything in the garden was good. There was one place where you could discover bad. Now we're getting a clue as to what this tree represented. We'll be back in a moment. Yes, as we look at the garden, according to Yahweh, Tob good was coal, ubiquitous and unlimited, completely and totally, collectively and entirely present and available within the garden. So, on this tree, the only thing that was unique was the access to that which was bad and harmful. Because, as we've made the point very clear, not only was every tree Tob, but in addition, he said that Tob was coal, ubiquitous, unlimited, completely, totally, and collectively, and entirely present throughout the Garden of Eden. Now, likewise, there has been no limitation on Dayat knowledge leading to understanding. Yahweh had already provided us with his creation account, which I'm going to tell you, having studied it every which way, provides more information about the how, the when, the why, of his creation than we're capable of processing. I mean, there has been no shortage of Dayat knowledge leading to understanding. And every time I go through it, I learn two or three times more than I did with my LastPass. And so there's been lots of Dyat knowledge that has been conveyed. So there's been no shortage of that either. And we find Yahuwah engaging in the garden in discussions with Adam, providing Dyat knowledge leading to understanding. So the fact that the tree of the knowledge, Dyat, of good and bad, that lots of trees, lots of Dyat knowledge, lots of good. Now, there's only one thing there hasn't been lots of. Ra'ah. Bad. So the only unique thing regarding the tree of the knowledge of good and bad was the awareness of bad. The one thing that is routinely expunged from God's presence. And therefore, if we are bad, we can't be in God's presence. That which is harmful and morally inappropriate, malignant and disagreeable, valueless and unpleasant, depraved and displeasing, causing sadness and distress, raw, is the antithesis of God, meaning that they are not God, meaning that we can't be like God or with God when we choose bad. Yet without the choice to choose bad, without access to evil, without a way to reject God, to choose not God, deprived of the opportunity to choose that which He is not, there would be no way to love God. Love requires choice. It is the only thing that cannot be made, compelled, or purchased, making love the most valuable and powerful commodity in the universe. Free will is the primary, but not the only prerequisite for a loving relationship. A person must also come to Dyat know the other party, as they really are. Otherwise, the emotional response is delusional. They can be no deeper than a frivolous fascination. True love requires us to be able to judge whether or not the potential object of our affection is worthy of this level of trust. Once again, this is the purpose of our nesama, of our conscience. You know, Mateteo, the Mormon football player at the Catholic University of Notre Dame, he had an imaginary girlfriend. The girlfriend didn't exist. He had chats with her online. He saw pictures of her. He had telephone conversations with her. It was a man that was speaking to him at the time. Yeah, he thought he was in love with a person that did not exist. I bring him up because he is not unique. There are all sorts of fanciful affairs now because of cyberspace and Facebook and Twitter and all manner of online dating sites where people exchange text messages and they have a fascination with a picture person's image and a person's tweets. That's not love. They don't know them. In reality, faith in a religion's deity, like faith in the gospel of grace and being saved by the death of Jesus Christ, it's praying to a Jesus, saying in God's name, amen. It's a faith in an imaginary entity. They don't know God. They have no clue what He's actually about or offering. They're unwilling to process the information that He Himself said. They're unwilling to evaluate what He Himself did. They're unwilling to consider His very source, which is the Torah. And so they have love affairs with imaginary deities, false gods. Now, there are two additional insights related to the tree of the knowledge of good and bad, especially with regard to knowing things which are evil, harmful, and inappropriate. Man brought these things upon himself. It was therefore inappropriate to blame God for pain and suffering, for crippling disease and for disabilities and death. Rather than saying a loving God would not allow suffering to occur, we should recognize that love requires the choice we humans have made to become acquainted with these things. Pain and suffering are a direct derivative of the choice Adam and Chawa made in the garden and of the subsequent choices we humans have rendered after them. We have brought these conditions upon ourselves. And a God that would micromanage everything so that no child would ever get sick, so that no accident would ever occur, so that everybody that wanted to be blue-eyed, 6'5", as a man and athletic so that they would win every sporting event, and every woman that wanted to be elegant and beautiful so that she could have any man wrapped around her finger and articulate and brilliant, and that everyone then would be the same. There would be no love in such a world. There would be no choice in such a world. It would all be a mockery. The moment that God engages and micromanages in people's lives and does things like find them a boyfriend or girlfriend, find them a job, get them to the store safely, the moment that God engages in choosing to heal little Sam but not little Johnny, then the whole thing becomes a facade. It's false. It's a waste of time. There's no reason to have even created the universe under those circumstances. Where do you stop micromanaging? Where do you start hindering others so that you can give to whomever asks of you whatever they might ask? You know, I want to win the lottery. Well, who do you deprive of the lottery so that the person who asks you to win wins? How do you decide between the millions who pray and say, I'll give you part of the money if I win, which one of those would you appease? And the whole thing is a joke. You establish a means to form a relationship with you, and then you would tell people, but it really doesn't matter. Forget about what I did. Forget about what I said. It doesn't matter. I'm going to be capricious. Whatever you want, whatever you envision of me, that'll be just fine. You know, if your God would do this, that, and the other thing, then so be it. I'll be the God you want me to be. You tell me the kind of God you want, and that's what I'm going to be. That's how stupid this whole thing is. We brought this upon ourselves. We do every day with our decisions. For those who fail to appreciate the purpose of free will or to acknowledge its value or consequence, and who continue to lament over a God who wouldn't allow any of the many atrocities and misfortunes that occur on our planet, consider what you're asking of him. Is Yahweh going to ground America's Air Force so that it can't bomb Syria? Is God going to wipe Islam off the face of the earth so there'll be no more suicide bombers? Is God going to eliminate the opportunity for you to be a Christian because Christianity has been so lethal to humankind? Should there be no choice anymore to be a secular humanist because there's been no more deadly human institution than communism, fascism? What were we asking of God if we ask this of him? If Yahweh were to intervene to stop all bad things from happening, the result would be to remove consequence from choice. Yes, you heard me correct. If God were to intervene to eliminate any bad thing from happening, he would have to remove consequence from choice. And doing so would completely undermine the benefit of free will, which in turn would make love impossible and our very existence pointless. There would be no reason for the universe to have been created because Yahweh would no longer be able to grow through loving relationships that we are unable to form with him. The idea of God allowing people to choose to be bad rather than follow his instructions is fairly easy to understand. However, when it comes to a child suffering or dying prematurely, it is difficult for us to appreciate how even the most trivial decisions we make can change the futures of those of others. Should God intervene and stop a company from dumping pollutants in the air, the ground, the water, to keep a child safe from getting cancer? If so, what about altering trivial events which might cause someone to drive a little slower or a little faster on a trip, consume an additional drink, or get distracted when the result leads to an accident? The smallest thing might only affect the rest of their existence, but also might impact the lives of others who are innocent bystanders. Should God have made it impossible for Tamerlane and Jokar to embrace Islam? Should he just ban the religion from the planet so that they could not bomb the victims in Boston and blow off the legs of little girls and kill those individuals, maim others? Should God have precluded Muhammad from existing to spare the lives of several hundred million people that were ravaged in the name of that religion? What about Constantine and Christianity and all of the hell that the Roman Catholic Church and clerics and kings together perpetrated on this planet? Should God eliminate the U.S. military because it has been so deadly? Where do we stop? What are we asking of God? We'll return to Shattering Myths for the final segment. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. I'd like to retreat a bit to our first hour because it has all to do with what should God prevent us from doing. You know, in Syria, with America and Europe now poised to start bombing raids and to engage in war with Syria, if you were Assad, and you knew that they would continue to bomb until they kill you, just as we did with Muammar Gaddafi, just as we did with Saddam Hussein, that they would keep on going until they kill you. If you had the weapons, now Saddam Hussein didn't. We entered Iraq and Allah didn't have them, so we didn't deploy them. Now, there is some evidence that a significant number of weapons that Saddam Hussein did previously have that he gave to Syria, and that's if that's the case, then our invasion of Iraq is what has prompted all of this now in Syria. But if he is cornered and he really does have chemical and biological weapons, what's he going to do with them? Do you think that he's going to send artillery shells and rockets into Israel? Do you think that's a consequence of him bombing? If he doesn't have them, then we have no right to go and bomb him. And if he has them, isn't our bombing of him likely going to cause him to react in that way? Now, should God say, I don't want Israel gassed, therefore I'm going to intervene, and the malfeasance of the United States in providing these weapons and the European countries in providing them, and then the malfeasance of arming the rebels in Syria to turn this into a deadly war, I'm going to turn back the clock, and this has all gone so horribly wrong. Let me just turn back the clock and erase all of those actions, and we'll start all over again. Maybe man will be smarter, better, nicer the next time around. Or do we just continue to have choice and consequence? Choice and consequence. But now, do you want God to eliminate consequence? And if so, does he not also have to eliminate choice? And then what have you? Then he does become a Lord. He can tell you what to do, and you have no choice. You must do it. In that case, there can be no relationship. There is no love. You see, all of this works the other way. There may have been an Austrian with a great affinity for painting landscapes who, for some reason, turned down a position on the admissions board by the admissions board at the Vienna Academy of Art. The person who was hired instead rejected the 18-year-old boy's application. In his opinion, the lad's work lacked appreciation of the human form. So how much different would the world have been if Adolf Hitler had spent his life as an artist, if God had changed the person responsible for the board at the Vienna Academy of Art so that he was accepted rather than rejected. What to them? Every decision, you see, has a ripple effect, and on go the consequences. So who knows what confluence of events bring us to a situation where something horrible happens to an innocent person, even if it were possible. At what point should God stop meddling in the minutiae of an endless stream of variables to prevent a seemingly senseless tragedy from occurring? What repercussions would his intervention have? And should, or what should also be considered, is that if Yahweh does prevent certain bad things from happening, at what point should he stop? If God engages in terminal illness for newborns, at what age does he stop intervening? If God cures all diseases, ignoring the obvious enormous ramifications, then should he stop all fatal accidents? And if he stops all fatal accidents, should he then stop all random acts of brutality? It's a slippery slope that can easily result in an existence where there are no bad consequences for any actions, making choice irrelevant and love impossible. All this said, other than the option to choose them, bad, evil, distress, sadness, don't exist in Yah's paradise, nor will they be knowable in heaven. By the time we arrive, we will have already made our choice for good. In Revelation, God specifically tells us that there will be no pain and suffering during our internal existence with Him. He tells us the same thing in His Torah. And since the remembrance of evil and displeasing things would surely bring anguish, all things must be banished from heaven, which means that God will not accept those who are religious, those who are political, those who have advanced these evil nations, notions that have taken people away from Him. I'm Yada. This has been Shattering Myths. Look forward to being with you at this time tomorrow.